Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is proudly sponsored by Trupanion, medical insurance for pets. Trupanion offers a breeder support program so breeders can send their puppies home with special offers to try out the insurance. Since the program's launch, the Trupanion policy has provided lifelong protection to over 19,000 puppies and kittens. Click the link on my partner page to get started so both you and your buyers can have peace of mind knowing your puppies are covered against the unexpected in their new home. There's no cost to you to join, so sign up today from our partner page and mention Pure Dog Talk sent you. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and we have back our very favorite guest, Dr. Marty Greer. And our veterinary voice topic this month, I think, is a pretty cool one. We are going to talk about anesthesia issues and concerns and questions that are very breed specific. Yes?
Yes.
Excellent. So we all, I guarantee you, if you've been in dogs more than 5 minutes, you have a horror story. And so we want to, right? Am I right? I'm seriously.
Yes.
What I want to do is provide people with information so that they are prepared, so that they don't freak out as soon as their veterinarian starts to put their dog under anesthesia, or maybe that they have information to share, right?
Exactly.
So this is our goal here, education. So take it away, Marty. I think this is going to be awesome.
Well, and you're absolutely right. Everyone has an opinion. Everyone has an experience with whether it's their dog or their neighbor dog or, you know, right, something else that's happened in their anesthesia. And it is scary. I mean,
yes,
you know, one of the things we learn in veterinary school is, well, anesthesia is controlled death.
Yeah.
So you have to be really respectful, but also really appreciative of what anesthesia has done for us. And when I think about the advances that we've seen in medicine, mm-hmm, whether it's human or veterinary, over the last 200 years, I think that anesthesia probably has made the biggest difference, at least in my experience and in my world. You know, yeah, chemotherapy, yeah, antibiotics, yeah, sterile surgery. But without anesthesia, a huge number of the procedures that we can do now that are life-saving would never have happened. Yes, I understand these other breakthroughs, but
right, anesthesia
is so impactful in our ability to wander through the human and the animal body surgically,
right,
in a way that we can cure things that we never could have before. So it's amazing.
And I cannot pinpoint a date, but I know that in the, say, last 30 years, the anesthesia protocols and drugs have improved tremendously.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I graduated 38 years ago. We were still using methoxyfluorine,
right,
which is a very safe anesthetic gas, but one that moved very slowly in and out of the system. We had morphine, we had some of the barbiturates, but we didn't have a lot of the drugs that we have now, and the breakthroughs are just absolutely immense in how we can manage our patients much more safely under anesthesia. And, of course, the monitors and the other
sure, electronic
equipment has made a difference as well, but the drugs are just immensely different than what we used to use back in the day.
Back in the day, right. And I think that's one of the things that we need to kind of put out there, right? That your horror story, tell me what date that was from, right? Because there are fewer horror stories today than there were 30 years ago. I think that would be fair.
Oh, for sure. But, you know, we say the same things about x-ray. I still have clients that are reluctant to take x-rays of their pregnant dogs because they read a study from 1962 that talks about the risk of the x-ray exposure to the puppies. Well, now we have digital. Our exposures are teeny, teeny, teeny. So we have to really look at what's modern and current and up-to-date because we now have propofol and we have alfaxin and we have drugs that we just never had before that are just unbelievably much safer than what we used to use.
Right. And I think that's an important thing because one of the things across the board, and I know you see this too, is that so much of our dog fancy is sort of stuck in 1980. I mean, don't mean to be unkind to anyone. I, too, am guilty of this, but I think that's a thing, right?
Well, you know, if that's when you started breeding,
right, then
probably, right, and a lot of our breeders have been breeding for 30 and 40 years. So sometimes those old memories do come back to haunt people. They just
yeah, keep
lingering in their mind. So, yes, I don't disagree with that. But we need to move forward and realize that there's just a lot of really cool things that have
yeah, changed
in the period of time that we've been breeding. So looking at things with a fresh eye, I think it's really smart to let go of the old horror story.
Absolutely. And even with all of that, there are still breeds that either genetically or phenotypically, whatever it is, have some issues with anesthesia. So let's talk about that.
Sure. And a lot of people, and we kind of laugh at the veterinary clinic because it doesn't matter what breed they have. When a client comes in and says, my breeder said, or I'm a breeder and my breed of dog takes anesthesia differently than every other breed, you know, we've heard it from every single breed ever. So it's not like even somebody with a Labrador comes in and says, my breed takes anesthesia differently. And so, you know, you don't want to belittle the client for that impression and the information that they've heard. But we also need to factor in the fact that, yes, there's a whole bunch of different reasons that different patients take anesthesia differently. So I want to kind of break these down into some categories. And
excellent.
Of course, there's the brachycephalic breeds, which are going to be the short-faced dogs. And they don't metabolize the drugs that differently, but they have a different, as you said, phenotype, a different way that their airways are constructed. So we have to look at those differently. There are drugs that are metabolized differently by certain dogs, sighthounds, the herding breeds, the Dobermans, the Boxers. Yes, all of those have differences. But we can get to the brachycephalics, which is more of a category. We can get to the toy breed and the giant breed, which is more of a category, not specifically a breed itself. So I think we need to kind of dissect all these apart, and we can go through these one at a time and just talk about those.
Let's start with sighthounds.
Sure.
We haven't talked a lot about sighthounds. We've done a whole bunch of brachycephalic and all this. Let's start with sighthounds.
Yeah.
I know, again, personal experience, this is something that is real.
Absolutely. And really the biggest difference in a sighthound is their body fat and their metabolism as a result of their body fat. So according to the literature, sighthounds have approximately 17% body fat when the average dog has closer to 35%. So number one, when you give a barbiturate and it's fat bound, it's going to metabolize much slower in the sighthound because you need more to get them under anesthesia, and then it takes longer for them to metabolize because it doesn't have fat to redistribute into in their body. So they're going to look more deeply anesthetized with the same dose of anesthetic than you will with other breeds. There's also the fact that they have a higher red blood cell count because they are sighthounds. They're
interesting.
Like the Lance Armstrong of the dog world.
That I did not know.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons sighthounds are used so frequently as blood donors is because when you get blood from them, you get more bang for your buck. So out of 100 cc's of blood, you get more red blood cells than you do out of another breed. So we know the sighthounds do that. We know the sighthounds have a lower amount of albumin, which is a protein in their blood, so that changes the metabolism of the drugs because many of these are bound to proteins. We know that the barbiturates are metabolized differently, and we know that because they have less body fat, that they're going to get chilled and hypothermic more easily than other breeds.
Mm-hmm.
So the toy breeds and the sighthounds, we really have to keep their body temperature much higher and work harder at keeping them warm so that we don't lose them to hypothermia.
Excellent.
We have little tricks at the vet clinic that we can do for that. We use very fancy things like bubble wrap. We can put bubble wrap around their legs.
Oh, my gosh.
And then we put little baby socks on their legs over the bubble wrap to keep the body temperature higher. So if we don't do surgery on one of the limbs, then we can cover the other limbs with bubble wrap. We can use a circulating warm water blanket. We can use a bear hugger, which pushes out hot air. We can use something as sophisticated as our clothes dryer and put a towel in the dryer and warm it and put it on the dog. We can use water bottles. So there's a lot of techniques that we have to keep dogs warm. What we have to be really careful of is that we don't cause a thermal burn at the same time that we're trying to keep them warmer. So things like bubble wrap can hurt. Those
nice
metal thermal blankets that you can buy, those little space blankets you can stick in your car as an emergency blanket, those work great. So we have a lot of really cool techniques that we can use to keep these dogs warm and safe at the same time.
I love that. So that's specifically to sighthounds. And do you use a different drug protocol other than amount, but do you use a different type of anesthesia drug for the sighthounds?
We used to more than we do now because we, in our practice, tend to use a lot of propofol and a lot of alfaxin, which is one of the drugs that's recommended for the sighthounds. But we use them for our C-sections and we use them for almost every anesthetic patient that we anesthetize, because we find them to be so safe and so easy to use, and they've now become so much more affordable. When those products first came to market, they were a little bit more expensive because there weren't generic equivalents, but we have much better access to those drugs, and they work really, really well. I've personally had anesthetic with propofol a couple of times, and man, you just wake up without a hangover. you can't believe how much of a difference it is with these newer drugs. So I like these a lot, and I personally don't care much for the Dextromethor, Rompin,
right,
the xylazine type of right. products. I personally don't care for those in my practice. I like using propofol, and I like using Alfaxan. And, you know, one of the reasons people like some of the other drugs is because you can reverse them, but frankly, they wake up so fast from propofol and Alfaxan that we don't find the need for a reversal. So for it, but we don't really find that we need it, because very shortly after you stop administering the drug, these guys are back on their feet.
Right.
And because we do so many, for instance, C-sections in our practice, we do about 200 a year. So our girls are on their feet within 15 minutes of the time that we've put the last suture in. So it's truly a remarkably fast anesthetic agent as far as the metabolism goes. So whether they're sighthounds or not, these guys are popping up to their feet really very quickly.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. And then again, the toy breeds you were talking about, again, keep them very warm. You know, my Chihuahua, she weighs 4.5 pounds. Mm-hmm. You know, you gotta, mm-hmm. that's a small little body to keep warm for all of that, right?
It is. And so some people use water bottles, some people will use rice bags. Those can cause thermal burns, so you want to make sure that that's not right against their skin. Mm. And they have no fat. The toy breeds also have no fat really under their skin, so it's easy to get that too warm, so you want to be really careful. The other thing with toy breeds, especially when they're really young, is that they have a tendency to drop their blood sugar. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that you don't withhold food for any longer than necessary and that you monitor glucose if they're going to be either fasting or anesthetized for very long, so that you can very accurately make sure that they're getting enough glucose to their little brains and that they wake up nice and fast.
Perfect. See, another one I wouldn't have thought of. Excellent. And then brachycephalic, we've talked, you know, we had a whole podcast on brachycephalic, but talk a little bit about some of the specific things that go with brachycephalic with anesthesia and the various airway structures that you have to take into account.
Sure. So they tend to have a more narrow airway, a smaller trachea, so we need to use a smaller trach tube. Of course, you don't want to put anything that's too large in there and cause irritation. You want to make sure that the soft palate and the saccules in the back of the airway are adequately out of the way. So when we leave a tube in the trachea after surgery, of course, as soon as they're put under anesthesia, tube goes right in. We don't like to use a face mask to put the gas into the dogs that are brachycephalic because they're not breathing well enough. They struggle too hard, and they really get very stressed and really hypoxic when you try to gas them down. So we always use injectables. We want to get that airway under control as fast as possible. Bulldogs, of course, they love to vomit. So given every opportunity, they'll vomit up something that's thick and nasty. So you want to make sure that you've got their airway really carefully protected so that that's not causing any aspiration. So we get a tube in the trachea as fast as we can, and we leave it in for as long as possible afterwards. A lot of breeds we have to be really careful with, that when they wake up that they develop the ability to start to wake again, that they don't bite into their trach tube. Well, the good news about brachycephalics is that their teeth are lined up so badly that the chances of them biting off a trach tube is somewhere between slim and none. Now, I'd never say it couldn't happen.
No.
But those bulldog teeth don't mesh the way a German Shepherd's teeth do.
No.
So they're much less likely to do that. And a lot of dogs do breathe so much better. The brachycephalics breathe so much better with the tube in their trachea. They kind of wake up and look around like, huh, look at this. I like this tube. I can breathe. So we kind of joke around in veterinary medicine that they like to get up and walk around with it. And of course, that's really not true because it can be a little bit irritating to the airway. So
right.
As soon as they're actually awake enough, then they're fine. And we do want to make sure that we give them medication that are called anticholinergics that will dry up the oral secretions so that they're less likely to have all the extra saliva and then, again, aspirate or choke on that.
Oh, interesting.
So we're really careful with.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So these are all things you can talk to your veterinarian about.
Yeah, I love this. This is perfect stuff for people. I think people always, you know, they're so nervous to put a dog under anesthesia for a variety of reasons. But I think when you have information and you can just kind of talk to the veterinarian and they can have a dialogue, I think that helps.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, veterinarians don't want to hear my breed, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
But they do want to know that you're educated and they do want to know that you have some background in this so that you can have a really logical and effective conversation with them and not just walk out the door saying, but my breed is special. We all know every breed is special. You know, as veterinarians, we never take any of this for granted.
Right.
But we just want to make sure that we're giving each breed their own particular set of needs are being met because there are absolutely differences between different breeds.
Absolutely.
And types of dogs.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. I'm so excited, and I just can't hide it. Yeah, I know, I promised I was never going to sing again. But I'm saying, our new audiobook is available now. Woo! Yeah! Pure Dog Talks, How to Stack Your Dog and Other Important Talks, is a 2-CD set featuring early mentoring episodes from the podcast, tips, and previously unrecorded pep talks. This is a power-packed opportunity for folks who don't want to search our exhaustive 260-some-odd episode library for just the topic they're looking for. This 2-hour series is a great resource for breeders and mentors, 4-H leaders, anybody that's looking for a straight line trajectory from what kind of dog should I get to raising a show dog, how to stack and move with your dog, to counting championship points for your new dog. Super easy to purchase. Just drop PayPal $25 a book to Laura at puredogtalk.com and make sure audiobook is in the comments and that your mailing address is included. Because shipping is free, that's on me, and I'll have it to you in just a few days. Breeder and mentor bundles are available. I'll give you a 10% discount on 5 or more, and this is a very limited print run. So get your order in today. May not be here tomorrow. So talk about another one I personally encounter, giant breeds, you know, these big guys, or in my case, Clumber Spaniels that think they're giant breeds. With short legs.
Well, they're pretty hefty dogs.
They are.
They have a little bit of a short and airway, but they're very bulky dogs. You know, they're kind of built like bulldogs in that respect, that they are pretty compact dogs for the heights that they have. So they may be especially significantly responsive to acepromazine and some of the other sedatives that we use. So the recommendation is to give a lower dose on those breeds. They just don't need as much of the sedatives as they do if they were a different breed, say a Labrador. And a lot of people don't realize this, but a nice thing about the sedation that we give before we put the patients under anesthesia is not just to relax them, not just to make them less anxious after you walk out the door and leave, but one of the most important things is when we use these combinations of drugs, and we'll usually use 2 or 3 different sedatives along with the anesthetic agent, and then a gas as well, that means each drug is able to be administered at a lower dose. So when you're giving lower doses of each, they metabolize more quickly. They're not as profoundly sedated. They wake up much faster. So that little polypharmacy, that kind of cocktail that we put together of different drugs, is highly recommended both for human medicine and veterinary medicine, because we can give lower doses of all the drugs, and it makes it a much safer anesthetic procedure.
Cool. So what other specifics do you look for? So you've got a new client coming in, and it's an ex-breed or ex-type of dog. What are some other ones that you look at, or you want to have a special blood panel or some of those kind of things?
Sure. So we have Dobermans and Boxers. Both of those are breeds that tend to have cardiomyopathy, as can Great Danes. So any of these breeds that tend to have cardiomyopathy or heart disease, whether they're on a diet that we've talked about before in the past or not, they are at increased risk of having dilated cardiomyopathy. So in our practice, every patient before they're anesthetized has an EKG that's read by a cardiologist. A lot of practices don't do that, but you can certainly request that. It's not that expensive to have one done, and it will pick up changes in the heart that you won't pick up by just listening to it. In fact, that happened to us yesterday as we were getting ready to anesthetize a boxer. She'd had a Holter monitor put on her for a 24-hour monitoring period a year and a half before, but it wasn't current. So in that year and a half, there were changes in her heart. So we did have a conversation with the owner about this dog's risks of anesthesia before we put her under anesthesia, because we knew she was throwing some occasional VPCs. So we wanted to know that. We know that not only do we see cardiomyopathies in boxers, but there is a subpopulation of boxers particularly described in England that are particularly sensitive to acepromazine, which is a pre-anesthetic sedative that we frequently use in our breeds. So a lot of breeders of boxers are very, very aware of this subpopulation, and they want us to limit the amount of acepromazine that we use in those dogs. So we're aware of that. And then, again, back to Dobermans. Dobermans and a few other breeds like Scottish Terriers, sometimes Pembroke Welsh Corgis, these are dogs that have abnormalities in their blood clotting called von Willebrand's disease. So they're more vulnerable to bleeding. So it's really not so much anesthesia as it is their risks of what happens after surgery. And then we can get back to the sighthounds, which also have some abnormalities in their blood clotting. So we can have DDAVP for the Dobermans, and we can use some other drugs for the sighthounds that will protect them from risk of breaking down their blood clots too fast when they're healing and starting bleeding again. So with advance notice, we can have those drugs available. I've had clients order them, particularly if they're going to have a C-section. They'll have those drugs in their hand so that if something happens either during the anesthetic procedure or shortly thereafter or once they get home after surgery, they have those drugs. So we have pharmacies that can compound those drugs for us and have them available. So if you have a breed that has that, or if you have a line of dogs that you know has that concern, with some advanced planning for your veterinarian, as long as it's not an emergency procedure, you can have those medications ready, safe, and ready to administer, and they're not expensive. And everybody feels better. The veterinarian feels better. Mm-hmm. The staff feels better. The client feels better if they're holding that drug in their hand, knowing that we can administer it if it's necessary.
Right. And von Willebrand's, for people who aren't familiar, it's a disease that I've personally not encountered, but I know exists in my breed. It's, and you're going to correct me, I'm sure I'm not getting this right, but it's kind of the dog version of hemophilia. Is that?
Yeah, it's very similar to that.
Okay. Okay. And so if you have surgery and your blood isn't clotting, all of a sudden there's blood coming out of all of these holes in your dog. This is a bad thing.
Yeah, that's a very bad thing. No one wants to have that going on. So it's great to have that advance notice. And there are certainly lines of Dobermans that we know have it. It's gotten to be a lot less because now that we can test for it, people are being really careful with their breeding programs and trying to breed away from it. But it's not to say that that still can't happen. And, of course, it can happen if the dog has either got an abnormality with their platelet count, which is not von Willebrand's, or if they've ingested some of the rat poisons and mouse poisons that contain vitamin K antagonists. So, again, you know, we in our practice, every dog that has anesthesia and has a belly procedure has, in advance of that anesthetic procedure, we test the blood clotting of that patient with a proton and a PTT because I grew up working in a human hospital, and I know these tests are not all that expensive, and our clients really appreciate that we are on top of it and not taking dogs to surgery that have abnormalities in their blood clotting. We actually, one day, a couple of years ago, we were getting ready to draw blood on a patient before her spay, and my technician flipped her lip and just checking the color of her gums, and she saw that beautiful turquoise green color that rat poison is stuck between her teeth because she didn't get breakfast that morning from her owner, so she went out and found her own breakfast called a block of rat poison.
Oh,
so needless
God.
To say, we decided not to spay her that day.
Good
or
choice.
For another 6 weeks. Very good choice. And what really fascinates me is Dr. Zella that works for us has been doing all these blood clotting times on all of his patients, and we have found, and Cornell is aware of this. Cornell is where we do most of our testing for the clotting. There's a line of cats particularly seen in the Midwest that have a factor 12 deficiency, which causes their blood to not clot normally. So these are not purebred cats. These are just cats that come out of the barn, cats that come from the Humane Society.
Weird.
And they've got factor 12 deficiencies. Weird. So they're more likely to have a clotting disorder. So it's actually pretty interesting what you find when you look.
Right, right? Isn't that true? And so then, it's amazing, a wonderful statement there. The only other thing that I think we might want to touch on is specifically C-sections, right? We've talked about C-sections, all kinds of things. But talking about getting those puppies up out of the anesthesia and the time that that takes and how we manage that.
Right, and depending on the drugs that are used, the drugs that we use in our practice at this time, we don't need to use a reversal agent on, but there are still practices that do use some. And there is a reversal agent called naloxone that will reverse butorphanol, some of the barbiturates, and help those puppies to recover more quickly. The drugs that we use are circulated through the blood, and, of course, the gas is not in the puppies because they're not breathing it in. But very quickly after they come out of the uterus, we've got these little guys recovering.
Right.
But, yeah, there's definitely differences in anesthetic agents. And back in the day when I first started doing C-sections, it was before we had some of these really nice short-acting barbiturates. We have Biotol, Suratol, Phenobarb, those kinds of things. But now that we use propofol and alfaxin, we don't need to do that. But in the day, we used to use a drug called Inavar Vet, which was a combination of fentanyl and another drug. And the fentanyl we could reverse with the anesthetic agent. The downside to that particular combination of drugs was they would still respond to a loud sound. And at the time, my children were very small and were have to come to work with us during the C-section. So, you know, little children are not easily kept quiet during C-sections when their parents are both occupied. So it's been a lot nicer to have alternative drugs that do keep the patients under anesthesia for a more consistent time period, and then we can get them on gas that is a shorter acting gas than we used to use back when we had methoxyfluorine. And of course, the anesthetic gases are much safer for us. Now, we try to eliminate all the waste gases that we can using mechanical devices to eliminate them from the environment that the people are working in. But nevertheless, there's still a few times that you have some exposure. So the safer anesthetic gases are safer, particularly for women who might be pregnant. And of course, that's most of our staff.
Right.
Our young women of childbearing age.
Yes. Something about veterinary medicine, man.
Yeah. You know, I'm an old spade female, so it doesn't really matter anymore.
Right.
But the younger people, we do have to be really careful with the anesthetic agents. So that's one of the other really important reasons that we don't like to use a face mask and just have the patients breathe in gas until they're fully anesthetized, because it leads to a lot of waste gas of the anesthetic in our environment, which isn't good for our livers, and it's really not good for women that might be pregnant. So anesthetic has come just a really, really long way.
Absolutely.
In the number of years that we've been in practice, and it's actually really a lot more fun to do anesthesia now, because it's so much safer and it's so much more reliable that we just know that our patients are going to be really safe. And it's easy for me to walk into the exam room and say to a client with a 15-year-old dog that has dental disease, a heart murmur, diabetic, and kidney failure, yes, we can anesthetize your patient safely to remove this mass or to you know, do a dental cleaning when they need something. Because some of these guys, these are not elective procedures. These are procedures that really just have to be done because the patients are sick because of their teeth or because of their masses or whatever.
Let's go on and riff a little bit. We've got a few minutes left. Let's riff a little bit on senior dogs, because I actually think that's kind of an interesting one too. Senior dogs of any breed.
Right. And it's a rare dog that I would walk into the room and say, your dog is too old or too sick to anesthetize. Now, it doesn't mean that we're going to be just really cavalier about it and say, no big deal. Because it is still a big deal. It's a big deal to the owner and it's a big deal to the veterinary staff. I've actually anesthetized cats in my practice that are older than my technicians.
Oh, my
gosh.
So
when you have the 23-year-old cat and the 21-year-old technician, you're like, okay, so, girls, here we go.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's absolutely true that I've done that. But, you know, so we're not cavalier about it. We're not casual. We do our blood work. We do our EKGs. We have IV catheters in these patients so that they're getting IV fluid support. They're going to support their kidneys. If they're running into a problem with their diabetes, we can give glucose. If their blood pressure goes down too low, we can give fluids pretty aggressively and give other drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But with all these things that we can do, our monitors are much better now. We have these cool monitors now that have Bluetooth on them. So we can leave monitor on the patient and leave it hooked up. And not that we walk away from a patient that's still anesthetized, but in their recovery period, if they've been lifting their head, they're starting to show signs that they're waking up, my staff can now take their iPod with their Bluetooth connection to the anesthetic monitor and run to the bathroom and run back and know that that patient is still safe, because they can hear the beeping during the entire time that they're elsewhere in the building. So the technology is, I mean, it's just so much more cool, and it's just so effective that we can do all this stuff. We can get an EKG and have a result back in less than 30 minutes. We can monitor from a distance. We've got fluid pumps that warm the fluid and that keep the IV pumps running so that we've got the right amount of fluids running in. Just the technology of how things have changed over the last 30 years has made anesthesia so much safer that people really should feel very comfortable with saying, my patient, my older dog, my older cat is going to be okay. It's going to be safe. It's okay to do these procedures, that they really can be life-saving and life-changing for these patients.
Excellent. Okay, Marty, thank you so much. As always, you are amazing and astounding, and I learn something new every single time.
Well, it's not easy to keep ahead of you.
Well, I appreciate everything, and we will talk again soon.
Great. Thank you.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our Dog Show Superintendents are the hardworking people who make the Dog Show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the Supers desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.